So it's kind of fun because I've not met all the other speakers I've introduced today, but Chris Stockhouse is going to be sharing with you this afternoon. Chris is the missions director at Cornerstone Fellowship Church in Livermore. Some of you may have heard of it. It's a large church in the Livermore Valley. And he is in charge of missions there, where he manages the local and the global outreach efforts, many of which are designed to assist the poor and the homeless in the East Bay as well as around the world. He wears many hats, and one of those is he is the founder and chairman, come on in, welcome, of what was formerly known as Pogloum Training International. It's now been renamed, and he'll tell you that story. It's now called the Red Window Project. This project is really a special project in that it is one of the first attempts to put together an aftercare program in conjunction with IJM, and this one is in particular located in Cebu, in the Philippines. And so that is a new venture, and the idea is to really try to address the problem of re-trafficking. So you'll be hearing about that from Chris. In addition to that project, he's also on the board of directors for ROHI Children's Organization, which rescues and restores destitute children off the streets of Nakuru in Kenya. And last but not least, he's the secretary for the board of an organization called Meaningful Life International, which is a Ghanaian project that brings the fresh water as well as hospital services and church planting in Ghana. So he has several different experiences to share with you today. Chris has a BS from San Jose State and spent his first year in another career selling software. So if you're lucky, you can figure out how you can make that transition if you're interested. And he has a wonderful family with two adorable boys that he has adopted through the foster care system. So he also knows a lot about that topic. So it's my pleasure to introduce Chris to you, and I hope you'll give him a warm welcome.
Turn that on. Can you hear me? Great. Well, it's such a pleasure to be here. Really so excited about the summit and the momentum that this is going to generate in the Bay Area going forward. And so really looking forward to seeing the results of what this has accomplished. So hopefully you all have enjoyed it. It's really a pleasure and honor to get to speak and share a little bit, primarily of our experiences with the Red Window Project and what we've learned over the last few years in battling re-trafficking. So I am also involved with a couple other organizations, which we won't really touch on, but very heavily involved in rescuing kids off the street in Kenya who are addicted to drugs and have been abandoned because usually their parents have died from AIDS, most likely, and working on rehabilitation efforts with them. And then also an organization, Meaningful Life International in Ghana, where we supply clean water, drill wells, and do medical services. So it's just such a privilege to get to be involved in many different projects around the world, and always a learning experience. And we're always researching and continuing to learn more about best practices of what's the most effective solutions to many different angles at addressing poverty and issues of justice. So our topic today is about re-trafficking, and specifically focusing on potential solutions to the issue of re-trafficking. Re-trafficking is exactly what it sounds like. It is when someone has been rescued, someone is a survivor of trafficking, and they either voluntarily re-enter the sex work trade or they are forced back into the sex work trade. I became aware of re-trafficking probably a little over 2 years ago, when IJM came to visit our church. IJM has a very good relationship with our church. Gary Haugen's been out there to speak, and we really built a close relationship in supporting some of their projects, some of their offices around the world. And they came to our church to tell us a little bit about the issue of re-trafficking. And since then, it's been a wild ride, and we've been able to learn a lot. But what we learned from them, specifically in the Philippines, but it's also true in many other IJM offices around the world that deal with sex trafficking, is that many of the survivors of trafficking that IJM has spent lots and lots of money and hard work rescuing from clubs and from brothels and getting into aftercare, many of them within 6 months to a year are re-entering the trafficking industry, re-entering the sex work industry. And it's a major problem for organizations like IJM who are rescuing these victims who become survivors. Because the amount of money they have to raise and spend to rescue one victim, it's a lot. There's so much that goes into this rescue and working with the police and the law enforcement side. None of them are easy operations. In terms of the expertise they need, the relationships they build, and the finances it costs. But to go through that much work and see the majority of those rescued victims within 6 months to a year back in the same spot you rescued them from, that's devastating to the whole trafficking movement. It really is. And so what they came to us about was they were presenting to us research that they had done on ways that they could prevent this problem. IJM, the previous year and a half, had hired consultants, one of which is a PhD from Columbia University in social work, to do research specifically in the Philippines, but also in Cambodia, of ways where we can improve the aftercare process that most of these young women are experiencing. So what's working, what's not working, that's where they started, right? They identified the problem, they began to research potential solutions to this problem, because it's critical for IJM's success. What happens after they're rescued, even though IJM doesn't necessarily own that process, IJM is really focused on the rescue, but what happens with them after the rescue is critical to their success. And so they invested a lot in this research and looking into potential solutions. They looked into organizations like just spoke earlier, Hagar. Many organizations they did research on and learned from in order to develop a lot of the things that we're going to talk about. But they made me aware of this issue, and it really caught our church's attention, and it was something we were immediately very interested in. So I made a trip to Cebu to begin working with the IJM folks and began digging into the research a little bit more. Began working with their field office director in the Philippines. And we began to continue to revise the model and explore what the model might look like and begin to implement the model, which eventually became the Red Window Project. I want to tell a story before we get into what this model is. I just want to tell a story, and it's probably not a story that is new. If you've been somewhat involved in the trafficking industry, you've heard a lot of stories, sad stories about people. But I just want to tell this story because it highlights a little bit of the challenge that exists when someone is rescued from trafficking. How major of a deal this is to reintegrate them into society, and how difficult a process it is. So I'm going to tell a story. Some of you may have saw this on TV. America's Most Wanted told this story. It's the story of Natasha. She is a Bay Area girl who was abducted. So I'm gonna read it to you, and I have a few comments on what this means to the story of re-trafficking and some of the solutions. So it was the spring of 2001 when a 19-year-old college student named Natasha walked out of a restaurant in Northern California to get a sweater from her car. The next thing she knew, Natasha was forced at gunpoint into the back of a Mercedes. According to Natasha, the only thing I knew about was what I've seen on TV, that you're kidnapped and you die. They rape you and they kill you. Natasha's kidnappers took her to a home and locked her in a room with no furniture and no way out. For days, she wondered what was going to happen to her, and then the door opened, and life as she knew it was over. Natasha grew up in the upper middle class suburbs of Northern California with her loving and supportive parents. At her private school, she participated in many extracurricular activities. I was on the swim team, I was a cheerleader, I was involved in student council, Natasha said. I feel like I lived a picture-perfect life. We had a strong mother-daughter relationship, Natalie's mother, Debbie, said. She always was comfortable coming to me. Her father, Stephen, was self-employed and spent a lot of time with his daughter. He described her as a beautiful girl with a heart of gold. All she ever really wants is to help people. After graduating from high school, Natasha enrolled in a local community college. Midway through her freshman year, Natasha was approached by a woman while shopping at a mall. The woman complimented Natasha on her makeup and asked if she ever had considered a career in the makeup industry. I was approached to do makeup for like on movie sets and for fashion shows, Natasha recalled. She says, "We're looking for girls to do makeup professionally. Would you be interested?" The woman handed Natasha her business card and told her to call if she was interested. A short time later, Natasha called the woman. After a series of phone interviews, Natasha was invited to an office to fill out paperwork and a makeup test. When she left, they told her they would contact her if she got the job. A couple of days later, the woman called and offered Natasha a position on the makeup team. They asked her to meet at a local restaurant to go over some of the final details. When she arrived at the restaurant, Natasha immediately sensed something was wrong. "I felt like the woman started being short with me and uncomfortable," Natasha said. "I felt like she was looking at her boss in a weird way. I started getting a completely different vibe." Natasha excused herself from the table. Her plan was to leave and not come back. But she was kidnapped when she walked out of the restaurant. When Natasha's captors eventually led her out of the room, she was introduced to a pimp known on the streets as Spider. Spider informed Natasha that she would now be working for him as a prostitute. And she wasn't alone. According to Natasha and the police, Spider had many girls working for him. To control Natasha, police say Spider threatened to kill her family if she ever tried to escape. Natasha also told AMW she was also physically beaten when she didn't comply with his rules. "The fear was constant," Natasha said. "It was constant. Please don't hurt my family. I will do whatever you want." Detectives say Spider even drove Natasha by her younger brother's school to show her how easy it would be to harm her family if she ever tried to run. Natasha's parents had no idea what was going on because Spider allowed her to call home. "I was able to contact my family and let them know that I was okay," Natasha recalled. "He would tell me what to say. We were always on speakerphone." Natasha's mother recalls talking to her daughter all the time. She stays connected with us. It was not like we were worried," Debbie said. "Everything seemed at the time perfectly fine. The only thing I knew was what I've seen on TV, that you're kidnapped and you die." Oh, I'm sorry. That was a repeat paragraph. Natasha and other girls were advertised on Spider's website. The women never booked their own appointments, and they never received any of the money. It all went to Spider. Natasha had no hope. She sacrificed her body and soul to save her family and was convinced she would die living this life. But police say everything changed when Natasha met Spider's latest victim, a girl named Karen. Natasha told America's Most Wanted that she felt an immediate connection to Karen. She took the young girl under her wing and tried to protect her. But it wasn't until one night, when police say Spider viciously beat Karen, that Natasha decided she was done with this life. "I never saw him beat anybody so bad in my life for the time that I was there," Natasha said. Her eye was like almost out of her socket. "That's when I decided I was going to get her out," Natasha said. Within days, Natasha reached out to one of Karen's prospective clients. She gave the man her own parents' phone number in California and asked him to call for help. Not only did he call her parents, but he also called the New York Police Department. Detectives found Natasha, Karen, and Spider's partner, a woman named Avisa Lavasani, at a hotel in Manhattan. All three were taken into custody. Lavasani was charged with promoting prostitution and later convicted. But by the time police learned where Spider was staying, he was long gone. Investigators originally thought Spider's name was Leland Reed and indicted him for promoting prostitution and assault. Police have since learned that his real name is James Vernon Joseph Jr. According to U.S. Marshal, he has a criminal history of burglary, possession of firearms, and fraud. When Natasha's parents got off the phone with the New York Police Department detectives, they quickly made arrangements to bring their daughter back home. "I didn't need broad details over a telephone call," her father Stephen said. "In my mind, my daughter was in trouble, and I had to get her. When you watch TV and you see these stories, you're always like, gosh, that would be horrible. I'm glad that's not me," Debbie said. "And then all of a sudden, you're the story. It's a whole different picture." When Stephen landed in New York, he couldn't get the police to the police station fast enough. Detectives briefed him on what Natasha and Karen had gone through for the past 10 months. "If I hadn't been in a police station with detectives talking to me, explaining what was going on," Stephen said, "I would have thought this was a story. There was just no way this happens. There's no way this happens to my family. I am the father that protects the kids." When Natasha finally was reunited with her dad, it was surreal. "I remember that we were at the police station, and it was like the next day, and he sees me, and he's like walking towards me. He's kind of teary-eyed, kind of crying, happy to see me," Natasha remembered. "All the cops in there are crying too. It's an amazing moment." When they returned to California, to the Bay Area, the girls were still struggling with what they had gone through. Karen stayed with Natasha and her family for a while, and the girls were never alone. I slept on the floor next to their bed, my wife slept on the floor next to their bed. One of us would always be there at all times, Stephen said. After a while, things seemed to return to normal. Natasha enrolled back in school, and Karen returned to her parents' home. But like all victims and their families know, it's just not that simple. It's not only affected my daughter, Stephen said, it affected my wife, it affected my son, it affected myself. That doesn't include grandparents or anyone else. Natasha tried to be the strong survivor. She worked at a local advocate group to help other victims and was a guest speaker at several law enforcement conferences to bring awareness to sex trafficking. She was on the right track, but like most victims, Natasha didn't know who she was anymore. She was going through the motions, doing what everyone thought she should do. But the girl and dreams she had for herself were taken away the day she was forced into the back of that Mercedes. Natasha had to start over, and that wasn't easy. When she was recovered, Natasha and her family felt like there wasn't anyone who knew how to deal with sex trafficking victims. In fact, there weren't even specific laws on the books in 2002. There were sex slavery laws, but not sex trafficking laws. It wasn't until 2004, when the Child Protect Act was passed, that people in law enforcement began to recognize and take sex trafficking seriously. Natasha felt like she was on her own to figure out how to fit back into society. It took me years to really find who I was, she said. When you feel like you're worth nothing, you're going to treat your body and yourself like you're worth nothing. And while you're healing, you're making a lot of mistakes because you're trying to find out who you are. Natasha told America's Most Wanted producers that there were decisions that she made that she may have never made if she wasn't sex trafficked. I definitely wouldn't have gotten into the adult industry, she said years later. My life before, I just did not come from a place where that's something you aspire to do. I know girls, she continued, that have survived being trafficked and they end up in clubs or on the street because it's like what I was saying. It's a reflection of your self-worth. Your behaviors and actions that you display are now how you see yourself, and that goes back to what you're being told when you're trafficked. 8 years later, Natasha finally feels like she's in control of her life and has found a path she is proud of. I never thought I would have what I have now, Natasha said. I thank my husband every day. I tell him he gave me something I never thought I would have. We have a beautiful child, and I have a place where I feel safe and not judged. I don't think very many people wake up like I do, and I just thank God for the little things. So that's the story of a local girl. When we think trafficking, we usually think international. But it happens right here. And what's interesting about Natasha's story is how much she had. She had a healthy family. She had wealth. She had so much access to support, to jobs once she was rescued. She had everything going for her, really. But her road was still so hard. A few years after she was rescued, she was in the adult industry, which she would have never done, as she said, if it weren't for trafficking. It altered her entire perception of who she was. That took a decade for her to get over. And she had a lot of people helping her. So my question is, most people who are survivors of trafficking do not have the support that Natasha had. They don't have that support. Natasha did, and it still took her a decade to begin to recover. So what I want to start to look at as we think about how hard and long the road to reintegration into society is what is standing in the way for these survivors? What is causing them to, in the Philippines, they run back to the club or the brothel. They run back to the pimp that was beating them, right? Which blows our mind. Why would you ever run back to a situation like that? Why would you ever run back to be raped and beat? But they do, right? There's something in there that's just drawing them back. So what is drawing them back, and how do we prevent that? How do we stop that? So I want to talk about a few barriers that these young, mostly young women, experience on the road to recovery and reintegration. I'm sorry, I haven't been keeping up here. So barriers to reintegration. The first barrier is spiritual. So I'm a pastor at a church, so of course I'm going to go there without a doubt. So, you know, Natasha talked about she didn't know who she was, She didn't have any self-worth. In my opinion, and according to IJM's research, we believe that that is fundamentally a spiritual problem. Your identity of who you are and where you get value from is fundamentally a spiritual issue. What we've seen in aftercare around the world, when a young woman gets rescued and she gets placed in an aftercare shelter, these aftercare shelters are phenomenal organizations, and they're doing the best they can. What they provide is they provide shelter, they provide food, they might try to provide some education, and they provide some counseling, some emotional therapy. The emotional therapy is absolutely critical, and it's a part of this spiritual piece. The trauma that these young women have experienced is so deep that it really does take professionals to begin to communicate and talk with these young women and work through them over the course of years through the reintegration process. But I'm not an expert in therapy. We partner with therapy counseling organizations, so I'm not going to dive into that barrier. But it is tied up in this spiritual battle, this barrier that they run up against. They hit this wall, and it's the wall of who am I? What am I worth? Right? And when they hit that wall, and they're in this aftercare shelter, right? And they see no hope for themselves. They say, how can I possibly function in the real world? How do I deal with these emotions? How am I ever going to get a job? I haven't even graduated high school. They have all these doubts about their potential and who they are. I mean, and they're questioning who they are down to the very core. And when they think back on their experiences, their experiences tell them that they're valuable in one way. Right, their experiences tell them they're valuable when they're having sex, because the last few years of their life, or maybe hopefully only a few months, but in many cases it's the last few years of their life, when they felt most valuable was when they're having sex with a man who paid to have sex with them, because during that moment, even if he forced her into sex, there's still this intimacy that. You just can't get around it, because if that man is the only person telling her she's beautiful and the only person saying affirming words to her, that's all the value she's seen in the last several months or in the last few years. And so what we see in aftercare shelters and what IJM has discovered is that there's a crisis of identity and a crisis of self-worth, and they make a determination that they're more valuable being trafficked than they are trying to deal with life in the real world. That they're kind of weighing these scales of where do I feel more valued, and I feel more valued in the brothel or in the club, despite the best efforts of these aftercare shelters. And so what IJM determined is that there's a spiritual component to this that is preventing them from moving forward down their path to reintegration. There's also another barrier, though. This is a major barrier, a very tough barrier to solve, and it's the economic barrier. A lot of our self-worth is tied up in what we do and our ability to make some money and provide for ourselves. These young women quickly determine that they have very little future economically, especially internationally, but even young women locally who don't have an education. They realize, hey, it's going to be really, really hard for me to get a job, if ever. And I just don't see any other way of making money. And so there's a major economic barrier that needs to be solved, along with the spiritual and emotional barriers that these women experience. They're going to gravitate towards things that allow them to survive. Survivors make a determination after a few months in aftercare that they will not be able to find sustainable or upwardly mobile employment. And so they give up. The third barrier we see is some pretty severe social barriers. So they run up to the spiritual wall, they run against the economic barrier, and then they run against the social barrier. There's stigma against them. There's many times, you know, Natasha was fortunate that she had a family that welcomed her home. Most survivors of trafficking do not have that, right? They come from foster care, if they're local. Or internationally, their family might have been the one that sold them into trafficking in the first place because they needed the money, right? And so getting the social issues that exist with no family, with no community, with no support, with no love, no real love, make the brothel that much more attractive, make the club, the pimp, that much more attractive. And they make a determination, that's the best thing for me, right? It's not a great life. I have to have sex that I don't want to have. I get beat, but I get food and I get people who tell me that they love me. So they hit these barriers and they return. So let's talk a little bit about what can we do? You know, what are the answers? How do we break down these barriers? So the more we did research and the more we sat on this and we prayed on this issue, the word reconciliation quickly popped up. And reconciliation is a big word that means many things. But we made a determination that reconciliation was the core of the solution of what we're going to try to do. And I'll explain that in a little bit more detail. Make sure I'm on the right spot. But first, I just want to read out of 2 Corinthians 5. It says, all this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. Now, there's a lot more that I could have read, and this is a big topic within the Bible. But reconciliation, according to the Bible, is the ministry of every Christian. If a Christian is not engaging in reconciliation, a Christian is not doing the work that a Christian should. The Christian ministry is, the Christian life is a life of reconciliation. Now, what is reconciliation? Reconciliation is healing relationships. It's putting relationships in proper relation as they should be. And there's many different dynamics to reconciliation. Now, there's spiritual reconciliation, which is bringing reconciliation between God and you, or God and people, right? And putting that, setting that right, putting that in right relationship. There's economic reconciliation, which is your reconciliation with the economy and bringing reconciliation there with how the economy is functioning for the people. There's political reconciliation. There is between, let's say, Jew and Palestinian. There's legal reconciliation as you fight, as you enforce the law. There's all sorts of dimensions to reconciliation. But it is the ministry of Christians to engage in reconciliation. And so as we sat down at the table discussing strategy with IJM, this became the core of what we decided to do in the Philippines, which is our test location for Red Window. And we've in the last 2 years, we've seen a tremendous amount of success. As we see, prior to this model, this project that we're going to talk about, we don't have exact numbers, but we estimate 80 to 90% of the young women who were survivors of trafficking were taking negative life steps. In order, their life was trending back in the wrong direction towards trafficking. We've seen that number turn now in the Philippines to where we're at right now is 77% of the rescued survivors are taking positive life steps towards reintegration. So it's a tremendous success that we're very excited about and looking to implement in several different locations around the world. But it's based on reconciliation. The first is spiritual reconciliation. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to go right after the issue of their self-worth. Who are they? Right? Why are they valuable? You know, it's most therapy and counseling in the secular world will tell you that you're valuable. But what these young girls will ask, they'll say, why am I valuable? My experiences tell me I'm not. Tell me why. Give me a concrete reason why I have value. So as Christians, we can answer that question. We don't just say you're valuable because we want you to be valuable, right? It's based on something. It's based on the fact that each of these survivors have been made in the image of God, that the human is the pinnacle of God's creation. It's of all the things God's created, it's the thing he's most proud of. It's the thing that he values more than anything else. Each individual human life, he has a tremendous amount of value in. And because of that, each of these survivors has a tremendous amount of value. More value than they can imagine, more value than we can imagine. So much value that God himself would die because he values them, because he wants to save them, because he wants what's best for them. So we can answer the question and deal with the issue of self-worth at its core, at its foundation, and build upon that. But the interesting thing about spiritual reconciliation is that we're not in control of their spiritual reconciliation. Sorry. Right? I mean, they can certainly say, well, I don't believe in God. Right? And that shoots a hole in the whole self-worth thing. Because their self-worth is based on who they are in relation to God. So we don't have the ability to make them believe in God, nor should we. It's their own choice. And so a lot of what Red Window's programs do is we address self-worth. We clearly communicate what needs to be clearly communicated in a very, very sensitive way. But most of our actions are focused on a different type of reconciliation. Most of what Red Window Project is doing is focused on solving the economic barrier. Right? These young women are alienated from the economy. And so what we want to do is we want to heal that relationship. And there's all sorts of ways we go about healing their relationship with the economy. Very early on, we have them spend time with survivors who are doing success, are successful in the business world. And very early on, we give them economic hope, right? So when they hit that economic wall, they've seen other women who've gone through that wall. And very early on in their recovery process, we take them to 8 or 9 different businesses. All 8 or 9 are in different industries. And we give them a tour. And the manager of this business or the vice president of this business will spend time with them, will show them what does this job and career look like. Right, so very early on, they get visibility into what's the potential economically that they have. Right, but the road to get them that job is not an easy road, but it's a road that must be passed. You must go down that road if you're going to reduce the percentage of survivors that are re-trafficked. They have to see economic hope, and it has to be real hope. It can't just be words. Oh yeah, you're going to get a job. Don't worry. You're going to get a job. It has to be real. And they have to see and celebrate those positive steps along that path. So we provide them with the perspective. But then we begin the hard work. Each young survivor has a different path based on where they're at, what their skills are, what their education level is. Some of them graduate high school and they have a big advantage. Others haven't and they need to graduate high school. And so we immediately begin sending them to high school through scholarships to get the education that they need. But they all go through training that Red Window puts on in conjunction with all of our partners, soft skills training. And so we begin to, when they're ready, work with them on the skills that they need to get a job. And so responsibility, dependability, how to show up on time, how to interview, how to create a resume, hygiene, what to look like. All of those skills are very important, and most survivors of trafficking don't have those basic skills. And if they don't show up to their interview on time, they're not going to get the job. So we spend a lot of time on that. and they graduate, and we have a ceremony, and it's a pretty big deal. As they go through this process, that we need, what we've found is they need to, there needs to be celebration of positive steps along the way. So our main metric of success is positive steps. Because it's such a long road, right, we don't measure, well, we do, but it's not our main metric. We don't measure how many women have effectively been reintegrated. What is that? What is effective reintegration? How do you measure that? We do have a metric for that, but that's too long of a view, right? I mean, it takes years for that, and so they can't give up, and we're always fighting the battle of them giving up, so we always celebrate positive step markers throughout, and there's a lot of positive steps that they could take, and it depends on where they're at in the process, but that's a very important part of economic reconciliation. Exposure to the career opportunities is essential. But then also, we begin job placement services. So we begin to work with vocational training centers, and we work with the business community. And so there's alternate paths. A young woman could enter into vocational training and get a specific skill. She can do all sorts of things. She can get a skill in working in a hotel through vocational training centers. She can get a skill in the computer industry, all sorts of career paths that she can go in. And we've got some fantastic partners in the Philippines, and we're working on developing new vocational training partners that will continue to assist these girls. But probably the most important part of the economic reconciliation is the work with the business community. It's essential to get the business community involved in the reintegration of these young women. So what Red Window does in the Philippines is we have targeted businesses and put a lot of our energy into that. And so instead of just focusing on the emotional health of the young girl, we're also out there working with the business community and talking to them about corporate social responsibility. And how can these businesses help their own communities, businesses that have been successful? And we begin to work with these businesses on corporate social responsibility and provide ways for them to get involved. And so we've had about 15 businesses in the Philippines set up, commit to hiring these young women and training them. And so they'll take them through a training program. So instead of doing vocational training, some of the young women will go directly to a business that will then train them in that career and then give them a job at the end of that training. And these are not jobs where these young women are weaving bracelets for 8 hours a day. Not that there's anything wrong with that, because certainly that's better than no employment at all. But when you look at jobs like that, how many of those women are going to be managing that shop, right? Not very many. Where's the upward mobility in that type of job? So we're looking only for jobs that have upward mobility. What jobs can they, if they're successful, go to the next level and the next level and the next level? And to find those jobs, you have to work at the highest levels of the business community within the community that you're working in. And so we work with these businesses, and we have them all lined up, and we have them committing to take these young women in, train them, and give them sustainable employment that's upwardly mobile. And you would be amazed what that does to their self-worth. When they get a job, that's a real job where they actually had to compete with someone who wasn't trafficked. They're interviewing. They're not getting necessarily, well, sometimes they are, but not always. They're not always getting special treatment. Some of the jobs they've been placed in, they're interviewing along with everyone else. And because of the training that they had, they performed very well. And the self-worth, that's when we begin to see the spiritual things happen, because what we've been telling them about God, that they're so valuable in his eyes, when they see their life actually line up with that, they begin to connect the dots. But until that point, they still have only experiences that tell them they're not valuable. So economic reconciliation is critical to what we're doing here. The last barrier that we need to solve is through social reconciliation. this is another really, really challenging puzzle in regards to where, how do we bring healing with society? How do we bring healing with family? How do we get them into community? But it's very important, and it needs to be done and worked on very, very early in the rehabilitation process. You need to have what we have at Red Window is we have counselors who immediately start working on the social side of this equation. So they're going and doing research on where's their origin of this survivor, who's their family, what was the situation, what's the story. A lot of social work, and so we're working with people in the Philippines who are experts in social work, who can begin to put the puzzle together of what does social reintegration look like for each survivor, and it's always different. But it's very important to find the solution. So, is there any hope of returning them to their family? Maybe that's the worst thing you could do. Maybe that's the best thing you can do. But obviously, that's the first thing you begin to explore in terms of social reconciliation, as you begin to heal their relationships with people. We're doing work as we solve the economic barriers. We're also at the same time solving a lot of the social barriers, which is the stigma they have in society, which is extremely challenging in some international locations, more so than here. But it even happens here. As the business community begins to look a little bit more favorably and with a little bit more compassion, as law enforcement begins to not see them as criminals but sees them as victims, we begin to see the process of social reconciliation happen for them. But they need to be provided with tutors, mentors, obviously therapists, career counselors, business leaders who can come alongside them. What's been very effective that we're learning is the church in this process, because very early on they can be plugged into a church community that is passionate about justice, about anti-trafficking, that is going to fully embrace them in confidentiality and fully love on them. And that's a huge missing component to their self-worth, right? Is the people that... don't just love them because I'm a therapist and it's my job to counsel you, so yeah, I love you. But I'm not bashing therapists at all. It's essential to the process. But who else is coming alongside them? You know, is there a community of people who, hey, I don't have any expertise in this area, but I want to love you, and I want to be with you, and I want to hang out with you. And sometimes those moments, when you combine that with they got a job, they really begin to see who they are, who God created them to be, and what their potential is. And the further they get down this path, the less likely they are to look back and be drawn to the sex work industry. So we got to focus on social reconciliation as well. So what I want to do... let me see how I'm doing on time. Okay, good. So I want to read a story of one of the young women that we work with. And I just love this story. And so let me find it here. Here it is. So this is a young woman who is still in our program in the Philippines. that's the wrong page, sorry.
Chris, where can we find out about Red
Window? So we just had a name change, and so the website's not up. But if you contact me, I can provide you with all the information of our organization and what we're doing. Here it is. All right. So let me tell you about one of our young women who we're so proud of. This is her story. The five women stayed close together, cautiously walking along the median of a deserted, rain-soaked street in Malaysia. The darkness and pouring rain were unwelcoming enough, but the emptiness of the streets was what frightened them most. No one to hear them, no one to help them. It was unfamiliar. And what was unfamiliar had recently become a very terrifying thing. At any moment, the approach of headlights could signal either a rescue or a return to exploitation in the bars. Malaya felt hope dying inside of her as she considered the likelihood of a taxi picking up five dripping, bedraggled women who looked more like beggars than paying customers. Giving up would not come easily to her, however, and she focused on her mind on one goal: whatever it takes, as long as I can go back to my family. As a high school graduate, Malaya was content with her work as a sales representative at a local mall in the Philippines. She lived happily with her aunt and younger cousin and enjoyed spending time with her friends from work. Although poor, she had enough to get by, and at that time she saw no need to pursue a college degree or higher paying jobs, until her grandmother suddenly became ill and needed to be admitted to a hospital. Malaya knew she needed more money to pay for her grandma's hospital bills, and the sales job would simply not be enough. The timing couldn't have been better then when a close friend from work, Sarah Jane, came to her home one day to offer her a job as a singer in a Malaysian band. A successful singing career seemed like the perfect opportunity to give her family the help they needed. Malaya trusted her friend completely. They had worked together and were part of the same social circle. So she agreed to quit her job at the mall and start taking voice lessons. Sarah Jane and her sister began processing the paperwork and purchased airfare for Malaya and four other lucky girls to join the band. After a month of preparation and religious attendance of voice lessons, Malaya and her friends packed up their belongings and went with their recruiters to the airport. They were given specific instructions for travel, cash for any expenses they had, and sent off with high hopes for a prosperous singing career. It was the spring of 2001. Oh, wait, that's the wrong one. Arriving in Malaysia, they were picked up and taken to their new living quarters, where they met the big boss and his girlfriend. They were surprised to find the house so secure, with walls and a gate surrounding it, as well as a heavy padlock on the main door. The girlfriend showed them into their room, took their passports, extra cash, and return tickets, and warned them not to believe anything that the other women living at the house might tell them. Exhausted from the travel, the girls fell asleep. The next morning, the big boss and his girlfriend woke the girls up early to perform the routines they had been dutifully practicing for the past month. Two were assigned to the band La Bamba. Malaya and the remaining two were assigned to a band called Fire. But Fire and La Bamba did not turn out to be bands. Instead, they were the names of bars, where the women were to be sexually exploited by customers. They were trapped and far, far away from home. The dream of success and a hopeful future collapsed as Malaya could no longer deny the nightmarish reality she had entered. "We were so shocked," she said softly, firmly. Even years after the incident, the deception seemed to strike her with the same force. Malaya is small, thin, and pretty, with long, straight, dark hair and pearl earrings. Walking through a mall in Cebu with me one Saturday afternoon, she is distracted by some children's clothes. "When you become a parent, suddenly all you think about is your child," she explains to me. "He is my life." Malaya has other motherly tendencies, including an evident desire to protect the people around her. Riding public jeepney to the mall, Malaya took hold of my arm when I was climbing out, apparently frightened that I would lose my balance. The fact that a woman half my size would think she could support me if I fell says a lot about Malaya. Perhaps it was the same sense of initiative that prompted Malaya to overlook the odds of five young women without documentation escaping from an influential and abusive bar owner in a foreign country. In any case, she was not one to be paralyzed by fear and panic. "I was the brains of the group. Every day, I planned to escape," Malaya said. "I asked the girls if they would go with me, and they said yes." On her third day of humiliating treatment by the bar's male customers, Malaya began to talk with a foreign man who visited the bar. Something about his face seemed kind, and she decided to risk telling him the truth. She told him her terrible story, how she had been deceived and forced to work at the bar. Touched by her story, the man gave her the information for where he was staying and agreed to help Malaya. Malaya shared her plan with the other women, and they began to prepare for the night of escape. They packed up their clothes into plastic bags and hid them in the trash, just in case they were not able to get back inside before leaving. After several nights of failed attempts, followed by locked doors and the high security at the house, circumstances at last conspired to create the perfect environment for escape. It was an ugly night with heavy rain pounding down on the van in which the women were being driven back to the house that had become their prison. When they had pulled in through the gate, the driver hesitantly prepared to get out and open the house door. Grasping at the first opportunity to escape, Malaya offered to let them all in herself and lock up. Oh, I'm sorry. When they had pulled up through the gate, the driver hesitantly prepared to get out and open the house door. Grasping at the first opportunity to escape, Malaya offered to let them all in herself and lock up the front door, saving the driver from a drenching. As large drops of rain pummeled the windshield, the driver readily handed over the key to the front door. One step closer to freedom, Malaya and her friends slipped into the house and up to their room for their remaining belongings. Gathering up their things, the women did their best to keep quiet. Next to the room, the big boss's girlfriend was sleeping. Any loud sound, and she might wake up and interrupt their flight. Once again, the rain that night proved to be an ally as it pounded on the rooftop. Any noise the five women made while leaving was swallowed up in the raucous shower. Still in possession of the key, Malaya unlocked the front door and let them all outside into the soggy courtyard. They retrieved their wrapped clothes in the garbage area and threw them over the nearly 10-foot wall, then proceeded to climb over that same wall themselves. Bruised and breathless out of their prison, the women found their challenges mounting. Unlike the crowded city streets they were used to back home, this one was completely deserted. They had hoped to easily find a ride, but instead they trudged along in the rain, trying to stay hidden among the trees planted in the median in case their boss decided to come back and check on them. Then suddenly there was a taxi. Malaya still sounds relieved when she shares of the good fortune this car brought her. She and the other girls piled in and drove to the hotel where the customer who had offered help was staying. Several tense minutes later, the man opened his hotel room door, expecting Malaya and maybe one or two others. He was shocked when five trafficked Filipinas showed up at his doorstep. The man panicked, thinking that their boss would surely come after him. He gave them some money before sending them away. More importantly, he put them in touch with a Filipina friend of his in Malaysia. During the next several weeks of their ordeal, she was the one who would constantly provide them with advice and assistance. The support was much needed, as anyone who has ever attempted to work through the bureaucracy of an unfamiliar country must know. Those usual difficulties were compounded by the fact that the big boss had confiscated all their passports, and he was determined to get the women to come back. Without their paperwork, the women found it difficult to find assistance no matter where they went. The immigration office, the police station, back to the immigration office, nothing was working. So we stood outside crying, Malaya remembers, when the boss came. The big boss and his girlfriend arrived at the immigration office, spinning their own version of events in order to convince the girls to return with them. According to them, the women were well taken care of, well treated, and well fed. It was not the big boss's fault they were unaware of the nature of the work. They could go back to the protection and generosity of his bars or stay in the streets, hungry, alone, and hopeless. Further capitalizing on their vulnerability, he tried tempting them back with the offer of lunch. "We were so scared because he was really a big boss, maybe a gangster," Malaya said. The big boss left, promising to return with food and no doubt hoping that once they were hungry enough, they would be incapable of resisting much longer. He underestimated their will to escape the abuse he had inflicted on him. The moment the big boss was out of sight, Malaya and the others got in the taxi to Miri, Malaysia, where their Filipina contact met them and assisted in processing their paperwork through the Philippine embassy. She also told them that their photos had made it to the newspapers, so to protect the women from being recognized and reported to the big boss, she instructed them to wear disguises when traveling between their hotel and the embassy. At last, after several anxious weeks of waiting, they were repatriated through the assistance of the Philippine embassy and the Cebu City government. Once they were safely back to their families, International Justice Mission, a human rights NGO, was called to handle their case against the traffickers. "At first we thought it was a waste of time," Malaya said, regarding the process of pressing charges against her traffickers. "But then she and the other women began to get counseling and support from IJM Aftercare. We were able to sit down with the IJM lawyer and discuss the importance of holding the perpetrators accountable. Convinced that testifying against their traffickers could help protect other women from the same fate, all five women agreed to pursue the case." The next 4 years brought significant changes to Malaya's life. She eagerly signed up for a home aid course with one of IJM's aftercare partners, only to have it canceled due to low enrollment. That disappointment was closely followed by the end of her relationship with her boyfriend and the discovery that she was pregnant. Despite the continued support of IJM social workers, the women who had refused to give up or let anything stand in her way as she fought to escape from exploitation in Malaysia was at last overwhelmed. Circumstances suddenly seemed beyond her control, and Malaya struggled with depression. "But then, when I saw my baby, all my problems washed away," Malaya smiled warmly. "No regrets at all." Providing for her son became Malaya's top priority, and to that end, she was relentless in pursuing job opportunities. She even began to consider further education to expand those options. "My dream is really to graduate and to have some job in a hotel," Malaya outlines her hope of getting a degree in hospitality management, some good opportunity. Fortunately, Malaya does not have to work toward that goal alone. She recently completed the job readiness training with Red Window, one of IJM's partner organizations in Cebu, earning the respect of her trainers and a scholarship. In June, she will begin studies for a degree in hospitality management with all the expenses of tuition, enrollment fees, transportation, uniform and shoes, and school materials covered for her. "During our sessions, I was impressed with her maturity and how she has dealt with the demands of her life," Malaya's career counselor at Red Window recalls. "Above all, what struck me most about her was that she has a sense of humor despite everything." Meanwhile, closure has at last been brought to the case against Malaya's traffickers. In November 2010, the woman who recruited Malaya and the four other women to Malaysia was convicted of trafficking and sentenced to life in prison plus 20 years. For Malaya, that dark period in Malaysia has ceased to haunt her present life. "We're kind of moving on," Malaya explains. And with that, Malaya tactfully indicates that she is done dwelling in the past. Instead, she shares with me what's important to her now, ensuring a bright future for her son. Back at home, Malaya shares a tiny room with her grandmother, cousin, and little boy. They have a bunk bed, a mat on the floor, a television, educational posters of the alphabet hung on the wall. Her grandmother sings, clapping her hands at Malaya's as Malaya's son bobs his head, dancing to the rhythm. Malaya sits on the floor, watching them both, smiling. It is easy to see that she is the caretaker of her family. Her grandmother and son both look for her for protection. This may seem like a heavy responsibility for a 25-year-old woman, but Malaya faces the challenge with confidence and maturity, as only a woman who has persisted through adversity and grown strong in the process possibly could. She is one of those women who stands out from the rest, one who will take the initiative that allows her to go far beyond what her own limited resources may pretend for her future, and who will make the most of the opportunities she finds along the way. So we're so proud with her, and actually, we wrote this, one of our employees in the Philippines wrote this story. It's all true, except her name is fake. And we sent it to IJM, and IJM's been in talks with CNN. They're looking to do a profile on it. And so we're excited about that possibility, because she's such a brave young woman. So, but she talks of these barriers and of the people who came alongside her and gave her hope at each stage as she hit each one of these walls. So I want you to, we're given next steps for you to think about. And I made mine all local, since this is more of a local summit. But I wanted you to think about how well does the Bay Area do at offering aftercare solutions? Are there any good aftercare facilities or organizations in the Bay Area? Many of you have met these organizations at this summit. So you've already kind of answered this question. Some of you haven't. I would encourage you to get to know who they are in our area. What is lacking in the Bay Area's aftercare response in terms of economic, social, and spiritual reconciliation? And how can you help to fill in those gaps? And so as you get to know these amazing organizations who are doing aftercare, where are the gaps in some of the services that they're providing? And not in a critical way, but in a way where people can come alongside and help fill these gaps. Everyone in this room has a different skill set and has different network of relationships that might be valuable to these organizations, maybe on the economic side or on the spiritual side or on the social side with solutions. Each aftercare facility will be better at some than others. And so we can all come alongside and help their efforts. And then the last next step is perhaps as you work with these organizations, you identify a way you can help and you can present it to your church, your company, some organization you're affiliated with, where you can get a bigger organization involved in assisting these aftercare facilities that are doing this hard work every single day. So I'd encourage you to take one or two or all three of those steps to really help our effort here locally. And with that, I think we have some time for Q&A. Yeah, we have 10, 15 minutes. So if anyone has any questions, I hopefully have answers. So yeah.
Okay, this is with regards to the economic reconciliation that you spoke of.
Yeah.
I'm a teacher in Vallejo. And a year ago in November, one of my students confided in me that she was being trafficked.
Uh-huh.
And she had been trafficked when she was younger, had gotten out,
mm-hmm.
and was in the process of being re-trafficked.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was talking with her about it, she had that whole mindset of, well, there's nothing else I can
right.
do.
Right.
I can't get a job. I don't have any skills. This is the only skill that I have.
Right.
And she ended up getting re-trafficked.
Yep.
So what I know, I volunteer with Missy, but have you looked at the whole issue of, like, getting a high school diploma? Because this, I'm not that familiar with the Philippines, but I know here in the States.
So important.
If you don't have a high school diploma, you don't have anything.
Yep. Yep.
And you, after the age of 18, if you're not in school, like, some McDonald's won't even hire you.
Yep. Yep.
And so what are suggestions, what are ideas, are there ways to work on that?
Yeah. So, gosh, it's there's some parts of the economic barriers that are easier to solve here because of our economy is better.
Right.
But there's also other parts that are more challenging, such as the demand for education is much higher. And so within the Bay Area, it's essential. They have to get a high school degree. And so the organizations that are providing rehabilitation services, that has to be a component of what they're offering. And we need churches and we need companies to come alongside and provide scholarships. Not that high school is, the fees aren't expensive like college is, but there's still the cost of living that a lot of these people struggle with. And so it's essential that they get their high school education and then go into the soft skills training in preparation for a specific career path. But my question is I haven't done research in the Bay Area, and I don't know what kind of job placement services are available for these survivors in the Bay Area. And I don't know. I mean, are there any job placement services that once this person graduates from high school, they have an organization that's lining up a job for them that is upwardly mobile and preparing them for that job? I don't know if that exists in the Bay Area, or maybe it does.
Hmm. So I don't know if they would have resources like Alameda
yeah.
County, Santa Clara County, as a referral.
Yeah, yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
You're talking about the aspect of the spiritual reconciliation.
Uh-huh.
Currently, Christians trying to give them hope that God sees their earth, but they choose not to.
Mm-hmm. That's not the end of the road. They don't say no to God, and we're like, okay, we're done. far from that. And even without a relationship with God, they can still be effectively reintegrated to a certain degree. And so we're still going to fight as hard as we can to knock down those economic barriers for them and those social barriers for them. And you know, it's not in our control as to whether they believe in God or not. That's not up to us. And so we're just going to do the best we can at the economic and the social. And when they're ready to realize their self-worth in relation to God, then that's just an added bonus. And we feel that completes the holistic care that we can provide. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. From person to person.
Mm-hmm.
But how long does it take them? And also, how long does the economic reconciliation take? How long does the social
reconciliation take? Yeah, I would say, it is different with every girl. I mean, if it's a young girl, it's a long road because of the educational path and all of that. If it's an 18-year-old woman who has a high school degree, you know, we're going to provide many years of service, but they can be, in 2 years, they can be somewhat effectively reintegrated in the sense that they're in a social environment that is acceptable. So they have either family or a community that they're living with that is meeting the needs socially that we all have. They have an upwardly mobile job, and are living what we call self-sustainable life, where they're providing for themselves and any family that they might have. We've seen that in 2 years, but it's certainly the process isn't over. There's still a lot of emotional healing that needs to take place, but they're somewhat self-sufficient at that point. So, yep, yes. Right. Yeah, no, that's great. And what happened in the Philippines with IJM and in the beginnings of Red Window was they did the research into what options are available like that in the Philippines. And as we look at additional locations around the world, say India, Cambodia, Thailand, we have to do that research all over again because the model of reconciliation is the same. But it looks so different in every location, whether you're talking about the Bay Area or the Philippines. So Bay Area aftercare organizations, in working with social services in the local counties, needed to, and we and IJM, I'm sure, would be happy to share what is that process of research look like in order to identify all of what's available. And what are the different paths that we want to recommend and provide for each of these survivors and manage them through that process of economic reconciliation. But you have to take a survey of everything, like just what you're talking about. What's available? What resources is the government providing? What do we need to supplement with that? And what does that path for them look like to find sustainable employment? Yes. Not currently, but we're developing positions for interns that have the right expertise to come in, and we're modeling it off of the IJM Fellow program, where they allow for fellows to come in and work in each one of their locations. And so we haven't gotten to that point yet, but we're definitely anticipating getting there soon, because we've had such a response of people that do want to help in that way. But but this is work where it requires a certain level of expertise because of the sensitive nature of the work and the specific things that we're trying to accomplish. But if you or anyone you know is interested, please come talk to me and we can connect and begin to look at different options. So, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so what Red Window does, it's interesting because we're not an aftercare home, right? We don't have a facility where we house women. We're not a counseling service. We don't have therapists. We're not a business. We don't have jobs. We're not many things. What Red Window exists to do is it exists to take all of the available resources, which includes all those things, aftercare homes, vocational training, the business community, counseling services, all these things that in many situations already exist in each location, but they're working all independently. And what Red Window exists to do is bring them all together, and we'll manage that process. So we're not housing any women in any facility, but we're bringing all these resources together for the benefit of each survivor. And we are providing some direct services like the soft skills training and the job readiness courses that they have to graduate and go through. We provide that direct. But the majority of the services that these survivors receive is through partners that we're bringing together to complete the whole holistic model, including churches as well. So, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I just talked to them, and they are really intent on buying Slate out.
Uh-huh.
And it doesn't quite sit well with me because I heard all like pros and cons of that.
Yeah.
And I'm just concerned that they'll be retracted. So
yeah.
How do you advise them?
I mean, that's a great thing to give to. I wouldn't slow them down on that if that's where they feel like they want to give. Because we're making progress on this issue, and there's no problem of re-trafficking if they weren't rescued in the first place. So we have to be fighting the legal battles. We have to be working with the police forces on getting them out in the first place. That's huge. And so there's many good things you can give to in regards to this whole topic on every side of the issue. I think that's great if they want to give to that. So I wouldn't slow them down. One more minute, and we're out. We have, yeah. I just heard about that from our executive director on location, and it's a new topic for us in terms of in every way, especially spiritually and socially. Right, economically we can still work, but they're from a different island, which is there's an island in the Philippines which is predominantly Muslim. So I actually can't answer that, and our executive director would be much more equipped to answer that question and talk through what the potential issues are that we're trying to deal with. It's a great question, though. It's a challenge. All right, well, thank you all, and enjoy the evening.